in God, there is no distinction between God and the love by which he loves. But there is a distinction in my God talk in the terms that I use. A subject plus a predicate joined by a verb. And so if I were speaking so that's one side. On the one side, I'm making a complex statement about a simple reality. God is love is a complex statement. But God being love isn't a corresponding complex reality. So the way in which I'm speaking about God in a certain sense is falling short of and isn't in that case modally adequate in a one-to-one way to the manner of God's being.
Does doctrine really matter? The Apostle Paul once wrote to a young pastor named Titus, instructing him to hold firm to the trustworthy word he was taught, so that he may be able to give instruction in sound doctrine. Welcome to Credo Podcast, where doctrine matters and theological ideas have consequences. Here's your host, Dr. Matthew Barrett, executive editor of Credo Magazine and associate professor of Christian theology at Midwestern Seminary.
Welcome to the Credo Podcast, where faith seeks understanding with the wisdom of the great tradition. I am Matthew Barrett, your host. Well, in this episode and the next, we break from our typical podcast style to bring to you two Credo colloquies. I sat down with philosopher and theologian James Dolezal to discuss the importance and significance of Thomas Aquinas. James has great skill and insight into Aquinas, but even beyond Aquinas, James has an eye towards Protestants, trying to understand why it is that some of the best Protestant scholastics retrieve Thomas Aquinas. As we talk with one another, James also reveals a number of important concepts for us today, such as participation in the likeness of God and the analogy of being, and so much more. I hope you enjoy these two Credo colloquies. And go to the Credo website for more conversations just like these with other great theologians today.
All right. Well, we are back again with our second conversation, and this is an opportunity for many of our viewers with Credo to have a chance to talk to James Dolezal, who is a theologian, but a theologian with a certain love and knack for philosophy as well. James, you've written a number of books. You've written an entire book on simplicity, but you've also written a smaller book called All That Is in God, published by Reformation Heritage Books. And in our last conversation, we explored Thomas Aquinas just briefly, touching on what are some of his unique, distinct contributions to philosophy and theology. But as we move forward into not just 13th, but 14th and 15th centuries, things began to change. And not everybody agrees with Thomas Aquinas. Now, there's so many areas we could explore here, but one of them is analogy. So talk to us first. What does Thomas mean by analogy? Why is that so important for how he understands the creator, the creature, even how our human language works and how we then perceive reality? And then talk to us about, okay, how is that then challenged with the rise of someone like a Duns Scotus and a William of Ockham and others who are not necessarily going to assume that?
Well, it's important. Thomas brings this up perhaps most famously in his question of naming God, the knowledge of God and naming him in questions 12 and 13 of the first part of his Summa Theologiae. And there he argues that we have no univocal or univocal knowledge of God, but that all of our knowledge of God is analogical. But I think before we get into how analogy is necessary for our God talk and our naming of God, it's also important to recognize that for him, analogy of being is a phenomenon not even first and foremost with regard to our God talk, but even with regard to our creature talk. Because being is, you know, if a student asked me, you know, what is being, if what they meant is, being's an interesting term. It's a term that it semantically covers a lot of things. I can say being about substances, dogs and cats and trees, and I can say being about the accidents of those things. Is barking, that has a status of being, purring, shedding, growing and dropping acorns, or these are all things I can say about different creatures, so that I can apply the term being both to the genus, but then also to all of the subsets within the genus. I can apply it to all the species and then to all the particulars as well. And so I can say Matthew has being, humanity has being, irrationality has being, animality has being. And it just turns out that being itself is something that I can say about anything that is, all the way down the line, both from its general categories all the way down to its most particular features. And so then how do I use the same term for existence? Even essence sometimes is called being, but in its formal aspect. How do I use the same term being for existence, for essences, for the entities comprised of them? So I can say a human being, but really what I'm talking about there is not so much its principles of being, but what results when they're brought together. Yeah. So it turns out that being is a word that we use about all sorts of different things, and we don't use it in the same sense. We always have a qualified use of being. And so Aquinas and others, not only Aquinas, I mean, you could also find something like this perhaps in Aristotle, that there's an analogy of being in which being is not said in a one-to-one way. So when I talk about the being of Matthew, and when I talk about the being of a whisker of Matthew's beard, which is gotta be like, so like it's a being that's dependent upon your being. And in fact, it wouldn't be your beard without you. Like you could be you without your beard, but not your beard without you. It could be hair formerly your beard, but I don't want to get too weird on your beard, but you get my point. Like there's I can say being about the substance, and I can say being about some particular smaller, like an accident. Dental state, for instance. And so how is it that I can use a single term about so many very different things? This is the challenge of, before it becomes a challenge of God talk, it's a challenge of creature talk. Yeah. How do I say being about so many different things? And so an analogy of being is really situating itself between, on the one side, what we might call pure equivocation or equivocity, in which a single word is used of two different things without any relation between them whatsoever. And so I can talk about a bat in the belfry, and I can talk about a bat in the dugout. Yeah. And the one refers to a stick with which you hit a ball, and the other refers to a creepy flying rodent. Mm-hmm. And why do I use the exact same term for both of those? I'm speaking, it's an equivocal use. So I can go to the riverbank and I can put my money in the bank. And if my wife says, if I say to my wife, I was at the bank, and she knows I like to fish, and she also knows I sometimes stop by the bank to deposit a check, she might say, the bank, institution bank, or the bank beside the river. And so there, sometimes words are used with no actual bond or connection. On the other side, in univocity, a word is being used in the same sense. So if I say something like Neil Armstrong, the man, and I say Matthew Barrett, the man, I'm using man, and I say is a man, I predicate that. Then I'm using man in the exact same sense. You're a man in the same way that he's a man. You're both, you know, rational animals of a certain nature, and you exhibit the properties, you know, that follow from that nature and that sort of thing. And then I'm using the same term in the same sense. But we can also sometimes use the same term, but in a different sense. Yeah. And so the analogy, the word picture for this that Aquinas uses is with regard to the word for health. For health. And so we can use the word healthy, and I can say Matthew is healthy, Or I could say, which health only really exists in its proper sense in that way, in a living body. Mm-hmm. But then I could also say Matthew's blood is healthy. And what I mean by that is not that Matthew's blood is itself a living body, but a blood test is a sign of whether you are healthy. So really, properly speaking, the prime analogate in this case, that properly speaking, Matthew is healthy. But when I say your blood is healthy, I mean, I'm only calling it healthy because it's a sign of the health in you. So properly, you are healthy. But by way of signifying your health, I can use the same word to describe your blood, which indicates to me that you are healthy. Hmm. You could also do, although I picked blood, they always use urine. They always talk about, because they're just looking for cloudy urine to, you know, this is the medieval period. They're not doing blood analysis, but they are doing urine analysis. So healthy urine. And he said, you could also use the word healthy with regard to your food, to your diet. And so you could say, does Matthew eat a healthy diet? Do you have a healthy diet? But diets aren't healthy as such. Diets are sources of health in living bodies that derive nutrients from them. And so what we really mean is, does the food you eat conduce to the healthiness of your body? Yeah. So the healthiness of your body is primarily in your body. But I can use the same term by way of analogy to predicate of your blood. I call it healthy because it's a sign of your health, your blood. I can call it healthy because it's a source of your health, your food. And so this is the question then. But then how do I distinguish the use of the word healthy? And it comes down to the way in which you are healthy. Healthy, not properly, but as a sign of. Healthy, but not properly, but as conducing to. Or healthy properly, because we're talking about Matthew and his body. And so this Aquinas will say, this is analogy. I can use the same word, not univocal. It's not univocism, because I'm not using the same word in the same sense. I'm using the same word in a different sense, but not completely unrelated. Yeah. Does that make sense? So the fact that I call your food healthy isn't unrelated to the way I use the term healthy with regard to your body, because it has a causal relationship to the health of your body. And so because of that relationship, that bond, I'm using the same word. So I'm using the same word in a different sense, but not a completely unrelated sense. Maybe that would be the easiest way to say, this is what we mean by analogy of being. When it comes to being, it's the same thing. When I talk about the being of, I'll just pick on you again. When I talk about the being of my friend Matthew, and when I talk about the being of his position, which is seatedness, and you're like, well, do you really call seated being? Yes, because I can say Matthew is seated, putting the emphasis on is, that's a state of being in which you find yourself, but it's not the same kind of being as the substance of Matthew. Matthew's substance exists through a primary act of existence, whereas your being seated actually exists in a way derivative upon your act of existence, meaning you could exist without being seated, but your being seated couldn't exist without you. And so there's a sense in which there's a primacy of being that belongs to you, the substance, that doesn't belong in the same way to your being seated, but I can still use being terms about both of them, but I can't use them in the same way. Hence, the manner of being does mean that we use the same word, but with a different sense, given the different things about which we're speaking. The manner of a thing's being actually does, in a certain sense, remove the univocity that I'm speaking and intending in a one-to-one way. When I use this term, we can't even do that horizontally, yeah, with regard to the natural world. Now, Thomas brings it into our God talk, but then I don't just say, you know, that quarks are and puddles are and elephants are and stars are and God is. I don't, you know, and I'm using being language all along the line, but what makes my predication of God's is, his being, not univocal with regard to the way I say being relative to creatures is the manner of his being. So that if I say God is and Matthew is, well, what's the difference then? And I would say it's the manner of the is. Matthew has as a principle of being, which we call esse, the act of to be, as something really distinct in him from his essence, not given to him by his essence, but rather given to him by an outside source and cause. Whereas in God, so your existence, by which I say you are, isn't actually you, it's a existential principle by which you are. But if I say God is, I'm not naming an existential principle in God, somehow more fundamental than God upon which he depends for his existence. I'm actually, in the case of God, and only in the case of God, when I say God is, I'm actually naming him. I'm not identifying a principle by which he exists. I'm identifying him himself because he just is his own existence. So Aquinas will say that our God, then this is all along the line. When I talk about God's wisdom and Matthew's wisdom, I have to distinguish the manner of your wisdom. You have wisdom. God is wisdom. If I talk about Matthew's love, you have love as a state of mind or will, but God is the love by which he loves. And so there's a sense in which the language is the same, but the sense and the manner by which it's true of God is not the same. And that, hence, this is analogy in our God naming.
Yeah. Even in what you just said there, God is knowledge, whereas I am participating in knowledge or acquiring knowledge or depending on knowledge, that seems to bring up another issue, which is divine simplicity. So talk to us as well. How does analogy of being, how does that actually protect divine simplicity? And how does a rejection of analogy for univocity, how does that tend to weaken simplicity?
Well, let's just take the manner in which I say it. We'll start with that. When I say God is love, that's a multi-parted statement.
Yeah.
And even in my thought, I'm actually bringing together the name God with a concept love, and I'm joining them so that there seems to be a conceptual and verbal distinction there. And yet in God, there is no distinction between God and the love by which he loves. But there is a distinction in my God talk in the terms that I use, a subject plus a predicate joined by a verb. And so if I were speaking so that's one side. On the one side, I'm saying I'm making a complex statement about a simple reality. God is love is a complex statement, but God being love isn't a corresponding complex reality. So the way in which I'm speaking about God in a certain sense is falling short of and isn't in that case modally adequate in a one-to-one way to the manner of God's being. But if I took it and just changed it up a little bit and I said Matthew is loving, let's just put it that way, and it turns out that sometimes, and I haven't asked around and nobody has said anything to me, but that sometimes Matthew isn't loving, yep. Just guessing here, that in fact, Matthew plus the love by which Matthew loves is not identical. And how do I know that? Because you change. And because sometimes you're still Matthew and not loving. in which case then, I can't say Matthew is the love by which he loves. I can only say that Matthew has love. And then my language, my multi-parted language, Matthew is loving, more closely, a multi-parted statement more closely maps your multi-parted reality. And the truth is, the way in which you are loving is not the same as the way in which God is loving. God is loving in virtue of being God. You are loving in virtue of an accidental state that you take on over and above being human. Mm. And so this would be one place where we'd have to recognize that our God talk, which is very much inevitably shaped by the shape of our creature talk, all of our God talk is creature talk, meaning it's not talk about creatures, it's creature talk about the non-creature. And so there's a certain inescapability in the creaturely shape. Our creaturely language and thoughts are largely, I don't want to say exclusively because I can think of exceptions, but are largely shaped by the nature of the creatures about whom we're speaking. But also our talk about God is largely shaped by the use of those terms as first used among creatures.
Yeah.
And that, so there's not a word in the Bible that we use for God that isn't first being used among creatures. So we don't escape the modality of multi-parted creature talk, but we do understand why, if God is the absolute first cause of all things and is pure act, that all multi-parted predication, while that may be a fairly reliable map to multi-parted beings, like creatures, isn't going to actually have this, isn't going to have that same one-to-one function when it comes to talk about God. And Aquinas will say, therefore, it's analogous.
So this brings up, this difference is a significant difference between Thomas Aquinas and Duns Scotus, for example. And yet there's some, maybe at times some discussion over, okay, how serious of a difference is it? And sometimes, you know, when it comes to univocity, there can be this impression that, well, maybe it's just a semantic maneuver in which we're just substantiating a knowledge of God, doesn't threaten the creator-creature distinction, as sometimes it's claimed, because, well, Scotus is treating being and metaphysics in a way that's prior to or even apart from, you know, discussions over a particular being like God in say, theology. Sometimes this discussion even goes further than that, right? To get into, well, God's not necessarily the starting point or subject of metaphysics. And so that we can kind of distinguish those two. And so univocity doesn't affect the creator-creature distinction. How might you add some clarification to that type of claim, especially given Thomas Aquinas' perspective? How might you address that type of objection that would say, well, it doesn't really affect a creator-creature distinction in a significant, serious, or detrimental way?
Well, I mean, as one who inclines more toward Thomas than Scotus on this, so far as I understand Scotus, which is, I should just clarify, say, this is a difficult thing.
Yeah.
I mean, the angelic doctor is the nickname given to Aquinas. It's very nice. But the subtle doctor is the nickname given to Scotus. And so it's extremely difficult. And I can't say to my own satisfaction that I've sorted out all of Scotus's claims to be sure that I'm speaking, according to the accepted interpretation of Scotus. But with regard to his insistence on univocity, even in our God talk, it does seem then very difficult to avoid. And I'm being careful to say I don't suggest that the implications I'm suggesting here are ones that Scotus himself embraces or did embrace. But it does seem difficult to, it seems to relativize the creator-creature distinction, even if unintentionally and unwittingly, because then what you do is you have to bring in something else beside being. You have to bring something else in and say, there's this other thing that this other, a mode, for instance, that is what differentiates. And it is in some ways very close to what Aquinas is saying. And for him, it's infinity. Mm-hmm. So that creatures are being like God is being, but in finite mode, and God is just that in an infinite mode. But the difficulty is, but when I say Matthew is, and when I say God is, am I using is there in a one-to-one corresponding manner? In other words, same language, same manner of predicating the language. And for univocity, he would have to say, yes, it's the same language and the same manner of predicating the language. And yet, again, when I use is of God, I'm talking about the divine substance itself subsisting. God is ipsum esse subsistens, being itself subsisting. So it's not just that he's being itself subsisting in a certain mode, like infinite. He's being itself subsisting as such. Mm. And it does seem that with Scotus, you end up having to add a modal qualification. Whereas what I'm actually doing is I'm trying to, in some ways, remove those qualifications and say that God isn't one who has being. A Thomist would say God is not a Hobbes esse, a haver of esse, of being, of active existence. He is the active existence itself subsisting. Whereas for Scotus, it sounds like he has an active existence subsisting in this extraordinarily boundless manner. Yeah. The way Etienne Gisson, the great historian of philosophy, puts it is that it does seem sometimes within Scotistic God talk and theologizing that it's almost as if the function that God plays is as the keystone in an archway that holds the archway together. It's the summit. It's the supreme. It's the highest stone in the archway. And it's the stone that if you pulled it out, all would crumble. It holds all things together, and the whole archway depends upon it. But also it itself is part of the archway.
Yeah.
And I think this is my concern with Scotism. And I'm willing to listen to real scholars of Scotus give their reasons contrary to this. But so far as I've understood him in contrast to Aquinas, it does seem that at the end, God sounds like the greatest thing in the world. Whereas in Thomism, he's not a thing in the world. He's not just I always tell my students at the beginning of a Doctrine of God class somewhere, God is not the greatest thing in the world. He's not a thing particular in the world, distinguished from other things in the world who are in a univocal way, beings univocal with God, differentiated by some kind of modal qualifier. And then they ask if that's going to be on the midterm. And I say, no, it's not. But, you know, this is the question of, is God relatively distinct? Is he most absolute in a relative sense?
Yeah.
Or is he most absolute because he's not an item in the world? And I don't know that a Scotus would put it exactly that way, but it does seem that with univocity, it's very difficult not to perceive almost a continuum of being rising all the way up to the very first and top member of a continuous kind of being in a descending fashion. At least that's the concern that some Thomists have had and that I would have. But again, he is the subtle doctor, and so there's room to explore that.
Hi, friends. This is Matthew Barrett. I'm interrupting this conversation to tell you about something quite exciting. Each November, we have a special meeting hosted by the Center for Classical Theology. This is an arm of Credo, and it's an opportunity to come together once a year in order to hear a lecture from a well-known theologian in order to renew and restore classical theology today. This November, Michael Horton will be giving this lecture, and he will be addressing us in San Diego, California, talking to us about what it means to affirm sola scriptura as it was originally intended, and how we do that in light of Catholicity. I look forward to hearing what he has to say, followed by a panel of other theologians discussing it as well. I hope you will join me in San Diego this November.
How then does voluntarism enter into this whole paradigm?
For Scotus, and then also Occam after him,
yeah.
Voluntarism is a philosophy that says most basically that will is prior to knowledge.
Yeah.
And so if you asked a voluntarist, how does God know what's possible? Let's just take that as an example. A voluntarist would say that God knows what's possible by first willing the possibles, not willing them to be, but willing them to be possibles. And then not necessarily in a time frame here, but in a logically second moment, so to speak, depending upon his freely willing the possibles, then he knows the possibles. And so the knowledge of what's possible follows the willing of it. I mean, the difficulty that I've always had with this is it sounds like a willing in the dark. So that God wills the possibles and then establishes his own knowledge by first having willed them. Whereas on a more intellectualist account, like Aquinas gives, God knows all possibility, not because he freely wills them to be possibles, but because he knows himself as imitable,
yeah,
able to be imitated in countless ways by creatures. And he also knows his own power, so that he, in perfectly knowing himself as imitable and in perfectly knowing his power and therefore all to which his power might causally extend, God knows all possibles before in a purely logical sense. He wills what he knows to be possible. He doesn't will the possibles to be possible and then logically, subsequently, to know them.
Yeah.
That would be kind of a difference between intellectualism and a volitionalism.
Yeah.
In volitionalism, though, because the willing of the possibles is not based upon God knowing, so to speak, his own nature, it seems to be not based upon that. That would be an intellectualism. that they also will assert that God has an absolute power by which anything sayable is possible or could be willed as possible. And by sayable, I mean things that we might call nonsense, that are violations of the law of non-contradiction. Yeah. A thing can be A and not A, and at the same time and in the same circumstances or same moment. Matthew could be sitting and not sitting at the exact same time in the same respect. Matthew could be, an unmarried husband or a married bachelor or a square circles, or this idea that by sheer will, hence voluntarism, God can make anything sayable possible, then there is no natures that God's knowing as possible. It's just anything sayable is makeable. And so you kind of get into a God has the power to make even the things that appear to us to be nonsense to be so. But I think what this does is it erodes common sense.
Yeah.
That to violate the law of being, whatever is, and then the second law, the law of non-contradiction that follows from that, that a thing cannot be and not be at the same time in the same respect. This is a philosophy that almost makes it sound as if God has the power to effect really and actually things that are and are not at the same time in the same respect. Mm-hmm. Now, that's an extreme implication of voluntarism that is not going to necessarily be owned by those who wanted to just argue nothing more than God can make even the seemingly logically impossible things possible or actual.
Now, you mentioned William of Ockham, and at this point, we have to put on the table nominalism. So we've discussed voluntarism.
And we should say Scotus is not a nominalist.
Right.
Ockham is.
Right.
Scotus is still a variety of realism.
Yeah.
So there are differences among these Franciscans.
Yes, absolutely. And those are important to distinguish and differentiate. When you get to Ockham, though, things seem to accelerate quite a bit, because now it's not just a subtle voluntarism, but now he's actually taking things in a nominalist direction, unlike many before him. And that seems to have some fairly radical implications, some of which he seems to anticipate, others maybe he didn't, but nonetheless, this commitment to nominalism, it seems to subvert a number of the pre-commitments of those before him. Thomas Aquinas just being, one of those persons. That it seems to subvert, for example, natural theology. It also tends to...
Well, it subverts natural theology because it subverts nature.
Okay.
So if you don't have a stable nature, he doesn't believe in universals, for instance. Yeah. So he doesn't believe that there is actually humanity in which we are particular participants. He believes that that what's real is nothing but individuals. And so in one respect, he begins to sow the seeds of an anti-essentialism, of an anti-naturalism, in a sense of there aren't dog natures and cat natures. There are just things of a certain configuration that are similar on a spectrum of sense experiences I have, that I have named.
Yeah.
Dog or cat or tree. But there isn't actually something like caninity isn't a real nature that in any way transcends a particular canine. Aquinas would say that caninity doesn't exist somewhere outside of particular canines, mm-hmm. but he would still say that they, but he, but or, I mean, Aristotle would say that, but he, and Aquinas would agree with him, but he would still say though that there is something in the particular that it has in common, a genus, even a species, with others of the same kind.
Right.
You lose the genus and the species entirely in Ockham's nominalism, and all you're left with is particulars, individuals. And then the way that you classify individuals is by names. But when I say humans, it's not like there is a common nature of humanity in which they are all sharing. Mm. That's just a name I've given beings that appear of a certain kind and of a certain sort. So when you lose something like a formal cause that is distinct from the material particulars, When you lose that distinction, form and that kind of form and matter distinction, and everything is just a particular entity, you're going to lose touch with nature.
Yeah.
And you're going to lose touch with causality.
And at that point, natural theology becomes difficult at best, maybe impossible in some sense, if you are letting go of causality.
You can't really even do a natural philosophy anymore, to say nothing of theologizing based upon causal contemplations about nature as a result of nominalism.
Does it also introduce a bit of a divide between faith and reason?
Yeah, this is a good, reason now can't get to natures, because they're not there. We can't abstract from particulars to universals. And so there's a certain curtailment of what reason can do in terms of abstractive ability.
Yeah.
And natural theology, I mean, Thomas's five ways are assuming that you have this ability to abstract to general principles from particulars, and that those general principles are true regardless of the particulars. If you lose that ability to move from the particular to the general, there's a whole causal structure that's going to collapse, and it's one that you're going to need in the development of a natural theology about the first cause.
Now, if that's the case, so we're trying to, you know, tease out why is nominalism potentially so dangerous? And this is really helpful, right? Because as we're thinking about our own context today, we've seen some of this play out. But it's not just faith and reason. Could we go further? I mean, how would nominalism then affect whether or how we think of, say, the Trinity? What would be the consequences at that point?
Well, this is the Trinity is somewhat different in that it's not an instantiation of a universal in terms of the divine nature.
Yeah.
So you have some exceptions there, but the ability to reason about like what Aquinas does in his defense of the Trinity, where he's arguing a certain view of relations as that which establishes reference of one to another, but doesn't necessarily inhere as an accident or subsists like a substance, and therefore is able to establish the otherness of persons without introducing accidentality or rendering us three gods. I can't imagine an Occam who doesn't think that reason can actually get to a stable philosophy of relations sufficient to mount that kind of defense of the Trinity. Occam doesn't deny the Trinity, but the arguments and the defenses made for the Trinity that were based upon, say, a stable and coherent view of relations, which was derived by contemplating relations in nature, if you shut down that access, then several questions of Thomas's Summa Theologiae suddenly make no sense, aren't even really possible to do.
Yeah.
And so you move into a kind of fideism where God is triune. There are three persons who are God, yet not three gods. And maybe you still maintain simplicity, not three parts of God. And yet the reasonable accounting of such a statement of mystery, not to reduce the mystery, but to give a reasonable accounting of why you hold the mystery, is really, you're kind of lost and you're pushed toward a sort of fideism as a result.
And would you also say, James, I mean, when this... does this bleed into even issues of anthropology and soteriology? So, for example, you think of Gabriel Biel, just on the eve of the Reformation, who Luther takes issue with. At this point, voluntarism and nominalism combine. And of course, he's building off those before him, like Occam, but they really combine at this point. What kind of effect does this have on everything from, like, say, a doctrine of original sin or God's grace?
When you apply nominalism to humans, or I'm sorry, voluntarism to humans, and you put a primacy of the will, suddenly there is this kind of newfound heroic notion of the human will that we can, in the phrase of Beale, each one doing what is in him.
Yeah.
And Beale is not arguing that you can receive, that you can earn grace, properly speaking, but he does say that you can prepare yourself for the reception of the grace. And you can do that by sheer acts of will. And this is, I mean, this is what's torturing Luther before his conversion, really, before his breakthrough, is this notion of doing enough. And it's the insistence that he can do what is in him, which he had learned from, the Via Moderna, the late medieval nominalists and voluntarists who were teaching this to him. And it does make an assumption that the will itself can, the will itself is primary. Whereas in Thomism, the will is moved by the good. And the knowledge of the good is primary, and the knowledge of the good that you need to have is a knowledge of God in the gospel. And that itself has to be given to you by grace to get your will really doing the right thing, so that your will can't be preparing itself. Your will needs itself to be given that graced knowledge of the good that converts even the will.
Mm. As we close, you know, our conversation here, maybe this, it'd be great for people to hear from you, James, because especially Protestants in particular, who may struggle with thinking, okay, is my heritage to blame then for carrying on a type of voluntarism, nominalism that really gives birth to modernism later? And a lot of Protestants wrestle with that or accept it or deny it, but are not sure on what basis. What would be your encouragement to them, not just in terms of looking back at their Protestant heritage, but how to move forward?
Yeah, I guess I think the history is, and the influences are mixed and variegated enough to not be able to say it's Protestantism's fault. Nominalism and voluntarism are products of late medieval Roman Catholic scholasticism. And I don't want to suggest that they're inevitable products of it, because there are late medieval Catholic theologians, I mean, even like Luther's mentor von Staupitz, who's trying to pull him back as he's going down this extreme voluntarist route. So then you have a whole bunch of Dominican friars who didn't go the route of voluntarism, or certainly of nominalism.
So it's not everybody.
The Catholic tradition, at least intellectually, I won't speak socially and ecclesiologically, because it's quite corrupt ecclesiologically, but in terms of its intellectual positions on these sorts of questions, by the time of the Protestant Reformation, it's quite variegated. Yeah. And even the ways that various Protestant reformers themselves are trained and influenced by these different traditions, the Via Moderna being late medieval nominalism, the Via Antiquia being more like Aquinas and that kind of Albert the Great style realism, you're going to find someone like Zwingli far more influenced by what we might now call Thomism, though he probably wouldn't have used that title. So to blame Protestantism
or Martin Bucer
as well in Strasbourg, there's an affinity for Thomas among some, whereas Luther wrestles a bit more. He even late in his career calls Occam my dear master.
Yeah.
So he's still wrestling.
A wrestling match to the end.
To the end for him. And it also accounts somewhat for his conflicts. I won't speak of Melanchthon, but of Luther's conflicts with the Swiss Reformed
on
the Lord's Supper. He thinks that Zwingli is, and Zwingli's being sort of very much like Aquinas in his use of reason, and Luther's being a lot more like Occam in his nominalism, in the way that they combat each other.
Yeah.
Maybe that's an overly reductionistic way to see their debate, but I think that's in the mix. So I think we need to be careful. There's not a monolithic scholasticism or a monolithic view on philosophy among Catholics in the late medieval period, nor is there a monolithic view among Protestant reformers on the same topics.
Do you think as time goes on, I know Richard Muller has done some important work here. It's hard in the first half of the 16th century to see some of these things, but as time goes on, especially with some of the Reformed Orthodox, is there a certain clarity that slowly starts to come to the surface, at least with some Reformed Scholastics?
Yes, but like we should be aware that the Reformed Scholastics themselves are fairly well invested in these debates between Franciscans and Dominicans.
Yeah.
And they're staking out positions often with the Dominicans, occasionally with the Franciscans, like Bonaventure or later Duns Scotus. I think it'd be reduction. It'd be too flat to say it's Thomism.
Yeah.
But to say that it's predominantly Thomism on balance across a range of issues, but with exceptions.
Yeah.
You find this in Protestant scholastic angelologies, where positions on individuation and what individuates, that's a very philosophical question. I don't think there's a Bible verse that you're going to go to that's going to settle that debate for you, but it does get into the question of how we distinguish one angel from another.
Mm-hmm.
And you might take the position of who cares, and that's one way of responding to it. But then it turns out that a lot of Protestant scholastics do care.
Yeah.
And you'll find some leaning toward Scotus and some leaning toward Aquinas, but the one thing seems that they're very aware,
yeah,
of the different medieval Catholic options.
Yeah.
On some issues, though, like on the real identity of God's existence and essence, they line up behind Thomas, like, yeah, almost to a man.
They're quite self-conscious.
Quite consciously behind him. On other issues about how angels are individuated, you're going to find a little bit more Scotism and Bonaventure into the mix.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's kind of a doctrine by doctrine,
yeah,
case where they line up with various medievals.
James, this has been so illuminating, and I hope those who are watching go and read James Dolezal's work, All That Is in God. Read his book on simplicity as well. We've been talking about even some of the Protestant Reformed Scholastics. Reformation Heritage Books is publishing some of those authors. Peter von Maastricht is Theoretical Practical Theology.
I should pitch Wilhelmus of Brockle as well, which,
okay,
they publish.
Who is fantastic. Someone I always recommend, especially the pastors. So some fantastic resources there to grab onto. Thanks, James, for this conversation.
Thank you.
Now you can fill up on theology each day by visiting credomag.com. There you will find the latest issues of Credo Magazine with articles on key doctrines of the faith and regular video interviews with Dr. Matthew Barrett, where he answers some of the toughest theological questions of our day. Be sure to subscribe to Credo Podcasts to join the conversation, a conversation where doctrine matters.